CKUT on the air. Live for CKUT. Oh, what? CKUT. CKUT.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
Welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the air. I am Benoit Gaucher, and up next is an interview with Derek Reinhardt of Good Food Meal Kits and a local Montreal area chef.
I'm with Derek Reinhardt. Mr. Reinhardt, what is it exactly that you do?
So currently, I am a recipe development specialist for Good Food. So I work from home writing recipes that are shipped to people all across the country.
And what is it that you have done in the past?
Previous to that, I was a chef for 23 years. I've worked in all different restaurants, all different places across the country, from Ontario to Alberta to Vancouver to Montreal now.
And I've heard that you've even worked in Newfoundland with Chef Anthony Bourdain.
I did. I was there for an episode with the Joe Beef guys where we spent a few days in the out in the middle of nowhere doing a giant Newfoundland feast.
What's the significance of Joe Beef to you?
I need a second on that one. Hold on. It was a place where when I moved to Montreal, I found a place that I felt really comfortable. I found a home to work at. I became really close with the team and the people there, was able to learn a lot, and particularly like learn a lot about how it is that I actually really like cooking and how I want to work with people.
And how was that?
It was great. It was a really good experience. I'm happy I'm not there anymore. No offense to those guys. At this point in time, I've just moved past being wanting to be cooking and be in a kitchen, which is the reason I'm not happy that I'm not there anymore. I'll always love those guys and be happy for the time I had.
Now, earlier you said that you've been all over Canada, whether it be living, cooking. Why Montreal then? Why settle down here, of all places?
It kind of happened with my wife got a really good job offer. She worked for the government, so we were able to move here with that. Plus, we're both from Ontario originally, and we wanted to be closer to friends and family. And her brother lives in Vermont, which puts us really close to them.
Now, keeping on that thought, as previously said, you've been all over, you've worked all over. So, would you say there's anything special about Montreal as far as our restaurant, food scene, or even just scene in general goes?
Absolutely. I think Montreal is completely unique in Canada. I think that the food scene, the ethnicity, the different cultures that come together here are able to create something that's really unique and special. And people here, like people here who go out for food are serious about it. They want a good meal. They know what they like, they know what they want, and it's easy to find here.
As opposed to?
Other cities can be a little bit more stale. Growing up in London, Ontario, which is, you know, obviously not anywhere near the size of Montreal or the scope, but people just want, you know, a certain thing where it's very meat and potatoes, nothing really fancy, nothing out of the ordinary, even oysters can be pushing it at some point. So Montreal creates, it's a special city for food.
Now, you've worked in kitchens. You've even owned restaurants?
Yeah, I was part owner of McKiernan. When I left to go work at Good Food, I sold my shares.
Now, you're making recipes now. You're working in a more corporate environment, a more media-centric, corporatized environment. Would you say there's a difference between working on the floor of a restaurant, working in the tangible world of a restaurant, and something more digital, something less immediately hands-on?
Absolutely. I really like the team that I currently work with, but that camaraderie in a restaurant is a bit of a different thing, especially when, you know, you work in a restaurant like Joe Beef, where you're there 14, 15, 16 hours a day, 5 days a week. You become really close with the people that you work with in a small environment. Whereas working at home on a computer is definitely a different ballgame. But we spend a lot of time on video with each other, and I'm getting to know my team pretty well, and it's good as well. It's just a different way.
So one thing that I'm sure a lot of people don't know or don't fully understand, at least because, well, solely for not being in the industry, not knowing the nuances of it all, the nuances of even the words even, you said that you were a chef earlier. Now, would you say there is a difference between being a chef and being a cook?
Absolutely. I think that there's a huge difference between the two. I just don't always think that it's a super defined line. I think a lot of it can kind of live in the gray zone a bit. I think most chefs are still cooks or cooks at heart. Most cooks, you know, can be aspiring chefs, but it doesn't mean that they are. I don't think being a chef is something, you know, just wearing the hat and the white jacket does not make you a chef. I don't even think that a chef needs to be the most skilled cook that's in the room. I think the chef is the person who leads and leads by example, and people recognize that and they want to work with and for that person. And I think that's what's special about being a chef is being a leader. I mean, the translation to French is chief, because it means that you're the chief, you're leading, you're in charge. And I think that's what being a chef is about. I don't necessarily think it's a... I think eventually you move past the cooking and you move into leading and teaching. And a lot of it comes back to that. It's teaching is a huge part of it. You want to have people who want to learn around you. And being able to show them things along the way is really important. And that's how you end up getting young cooks who want to work for you and with you, is so that they can learn.
Do you think one's education plays a role? For example... Do you think someone who hasn't gone to culinary school can be a chef? Do you think that someone who has gone to culinary school could just be a cook?
I don't think anyone needs to go to culinary school. Am I happy I went to culinary school? Absolutely. And I would definitely recommend it to people who want to learn. But I think going to culinary school doesn't teach you a thing about working in a restaurant, which is a really weird thing about it, because when you go there, you feel that you're going to learn that, but you don't. They don't even teach you how to change a deep fryer or light a pilot light on an oven. Like, they don't teach you any of the basics of actual restaurant work. But what you learn is you learn foundations, and you learn knife skills, and you learn how to make a stock and how to make a soup and how to make a loaf of bread. These are really important things. These are also things that if you find the right chef at a restaurant, that you could go learn in the industry. But walking in and having that experience is definitely beneficial.
So, what would you say draws you personally to a restaurant? What do you look for, or what did you look for when you were working on the floors of restaurants? What did you look for when you were working in the kitchens of restaurants?
Working with a team who acts as a team. You know, you work in a small environment that lots of times can be really hot, not always the most pleasant. So being with people that you want to work with, and you want to, like, you work together is really, really important for me. It's super important to always do like a working trial shift, basically it's called, so that you understand who you're going to work with, which is, I think, almost more important than the food sometimes. But also, it's finding a place where you believe in what they're doing. Like, going and working at a place where you don't like the food doesn't do you any favors, other than it just being a job. If you're just looking for a job, it's a different story. But if you're looking to learn and grow as a cook or a chef, you want to find a place that you really believe in to do it.
Has COVID been impacting life, well, for maybe your friends still working in restaurants, or even you working with recipes? Has it affected you at all now that you're doing a more digital job, or...
COVID has drastically impacted everything. I mean, the world over, obviously, but I think particularly in the restaurant industry has been really hard hit. I mean, for myself, pre-COVID, I was still working in a restaurant, owned a restaurant, and now I'm working at home on a computer. So it has really changed things a lot for me. Just changed the way that I look at life. As far as the restaurant industry goes, I don't think it'll ever be the same. I think, yes, people are absolutely going to go out for dinner. The restaurants are not going to die completely. New restaurants will open. But I would never open a restaurant now without having in the back of my mind, how would I shift to takeout? How would I do that if I had to, if this ever happened again? I think we're going to see a lot of... I think. COVID has played a big part.
A lot of restaurants now, yeah, are not very optional... Operational, and at this point are more so counters than they are restaurants. Do you think this sort of format of a restaurant that's more of a counter than anything, meaning it doesn't have seating, all it really is a place to get your food, to pick up your food, do you think this format will become more common after COVID, or do you think this is solely a reaction to the times we're in?
It's definitely both. It was reactionary to begin with, which is why people are doing it. I think that we'll see it become less and less, hopefully, as one day COVID goes away. But I definitely think that people have become used to it and they like it. They like being able to pick up a meal and take it home. So I do think that we will still see that in the future, 10 years from now. I don't think it's going away permanently, no.
It's harder to go to those little restaurants. It's harder to maybe... It's hard to get food outside of chains. So, has there been anywhere you've been ordering from that's been keeping you well-fed, keeping you happy? Has there been... What have you been doing as far as eating?
Well, absolutely. I would actually counter that a little bit by saying it's actually... I mean, if you're willing to spend for the delivery fees and everything, I mean, every restaurant who was a really good quality, expensive restaurant is now doing takeout. So, you know, you take Joe Beef, for example, that had a 3-month wait list. Well, I could pull up my phone right now and order food and have it in an hour, which you could never have before. So it actually changed the game a little bit. But again, you're not getting the experience. You're not there. As far as restaurants like that I like to order from, a great friend owns a restaurant called Beba in Verdun. They do just amazing food, but they've been doing a lot of empanadas and Argentinian-style food. It's incredible. Monkland Tavern in NDG does fantastic takeout food with an amazing wine list. You can pick up wines to go. McKiernan, my former restaurant, doing the same thing. Places all over town are doing this. But you can also... You know, you can get that comfort food. You could order the cheese and get a grilled cheese and tater tots. Like, this kind of stuff is delicious. But I really think that this pandemic has caused a lot of people to learn how to cook more. So they're researching, they're reading, they're buying cookbooks, they're going to the store, they're coming home, they're spending hours making themselves a lovely meal because they learned how to do it finally.
So when you say get takeout, you mean over Uber, yes?
I mean, Uber's there for a reason, and it's popular for a reason. Obviously, it's the number one. It's not very good for restaurants. Like, Uber charges 30% to all the restaurants that they deal with. So, you know, when you look at a restaurant, the average restaurant of, you know, if you're getting a 10% profit margin at the end of the year, you're doing yourself really well. Well, when you start giving 30% to Uber, it's not really good for anybody. CheckPlease is a great app. It's a local Montreal startup. If you order CheckPlease, the restaurant actually gets all the money. You pay a flat rate to CheckPlease. That covers all the delivery, but the restaurant actually gets to keep the money. I think more and more people should start ordering from apps like that or going to pick up the food themselves.
Well, Mr. Reinhardt, it's been a pleasure. I'm with Derek Reinhardt.
Benoit, thank you so much for your time. I think that I really enjoyed this. I hope people got a little bit out of it. And yeah, thanks for the lovely interview.
That has been Derek Reinhardt of Good Food Meal Kits and a local Montreal area chef. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the air, and I am Benoit Michael Gaucher.
Welcome back, everyone, to CKUT 90.3 FM. And if you're wondering what exactly IT stands for, well, it's information technology, and I've got a man right here to explain to you exactly a branch of field service management. His name is Michael Bedard, and he's here to explain to us what exactly is IT and what is field service management.
So what I do on a daily basis is deal with what we call field service management, or FSM, and that's scheduling and managing technicians that work out in the field, such as bell technicians, for example, for telephone companies, or it could be for repairing air conditioning units on buildings, for example. Those are all types of field service management technicians that would work in the field, and then we would manage their time, their skills, the parts they need to do their work, scheduling their, making sure they have all the parts on the truck that they need. So when they get to the site, they can do the work properly. They record how much time they work, all the parts they used in order to bill the customer, and so on.
Born in 1970, would you have ever imagined that today you'd be working a full day on your computer in field service management when there was, I mean, really virtually no technology back in those days, and really there was no technological affiliation to any sort of businesses? So I just want to ask you, how do you feel about working in field service management?
Yeah, so I mean, back in the day, the closest thing we got to technology was the invention of the video games that came out on Atari, and games like Pong and stuff. And even when I was young, I played them, but I was not that great at it and not really super interested. But as I got older, you know, when the internet came along, well, even before that, in high school, actually, there was computer lab at school, and computers were so foreign to us. And of course, I went into class with absolutely no interest in computers at all. We just fooled around with them and did what we could. But had I taken it seriously, I realize now that I probably would have been even much further along than I am today. So it's hard to believe in my mind that I'm actually working on a computer every day, because I had really no background at all.
So, Michael, if you don't mind me asking, having said that, how exactly did you get into IT and field service management specifically?
So it's kind of an interesting story, because I was always working in, you know, manufacturing or production or even sales for things that were unrelated to technology completely. And but as time went on and I actually started my own business, I started to discover some things that I saw on the internet that really captured my interest. And I started investigating. I ended up going to John Abbott actually to take Python coding, just because I felt like maybe it's something I should try and learn and see if I had an aptitude for it. So I started there, and then I sort of got the bug for technology and realized, well, maybe if I went into sales for technology, because I had background in sales, but if I got into something like technology, then I'd be really on the cusp of new cutting edge things. So I looked around, I asked around, I tried to get interviews with all these companies. I got turned down all over the place until one gentleman actually gave me a chance and hired me as a subcontractor. And I was hired more for the sales, and I ended up actually doing an implementation of software with Microsoft Dynamics. So it's stuff I didn't know anything about. And then from there, they ended up hiring me. I kept on learning and advancing. And today I've been 4 years with Go Solutions, working in field service management with a software from Sweden called IFS. And yeah, I've been enjoying it very much, and I've learned a lot.
So if you had to give some words of encouragement for some of the young people out there who are looking to get into some sort of IT, what would those words be?
I would say, if you're not sure what you want to do or you want to try something new, I would venture into it and see, because you start in one place and you'll invariably end up in another, all within the IT realm. But because there's so much, usually the path is not a direct line, and you sort of start in one spot and then someone will introduce you to something else, and you'll sort of make a 90-degree turn, and then you're doing something else that you're even better at or you have an aptitude for. So I would say, if anyone has any consideration or thought of going into it, I would fully encourage them to give it a shot, because there's a lot of opportunity to make a great career out of it. And of course, it's something that's going to be there for the for many years to come.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Bedard, thank you so much for hopping on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we'll see you all next time.
Hi, my name is Zachary Fleury, and today I'll be telling a story for CKUT 90.3 FM. To begin this story, I have to mention that I work by contract, so I'm always driving around to Montreal, Quebec City, anywhere close to where I live. And so for this contract, I had to drive up to Arundel in the Laurentians. The day before, I'm checking the routes to get there in the morning, and I see this one which, on the map, looks so much shorter. And hey, if I can lose some minutes, gain some sleep, I'm all for it. The side story that crosses paths with my drive up to Arundel started the week before. An idea that was present on my mind leading up to that contract was how I have to be successful enough to be able to lead a spiritual life out of my structured life, out of work, out of the household, out of a family context. And I thought that I had to make enough money to afford the luxury of leading a spiritual life, especially to live it fully without being held back by my obligations, to leave maybe for a month or two or three or a year or a couple. My opinion since then has changed. I believe that it's possible to live it fully, always. That you can live a spiritual life in your everyday life, that you should make your everyday life your spiritual life. But I was talking to one of my friends about this the day before driving to Arundel, and how beautiful it would be and how amazing it would be to be able to live our spiritual journey and explore ourselves and travel and find ourselves and learn. The conversation came to be that I have to make money. I have to. I don't have a choice. This is how I'll be able to do this. And so the next day I drive to Arundel. It's maybe an hour and a half, 2 hour drive, which ended up being a lot more. The road I had chosen was this beautiful road following the Vignivac Rouge, and the views are amazing and amazing and amazing. Could I realize why this road isn't the fastest way to get to Arundel? The road gets terrible, and I mean gravel roads, potholes left and right, and I soon realize, first, I'm going to be late to work, second, I'm ruining my car, last, there is no way. Speaking of a spiritual retreat, to be able to fulfill that aspect of my life, in the middle of the forest, over an hour down this gravel road, in Quebec, I see this huge Buddhist temple, and I mean, very big. And I'm amazed, not only by the temple, but also because, oh my god, this is what I've been speaking about the day before. Though I'm not a Buddhist, I do believe that my values and spiritual beliefs go hand in hand with Buddhist beliefs. And I believe that the Buddhist way of life is one of the many that hold that much beauty. And so I'm gazing at it, amazed. Until I hit the pothole of a lifetime. A very big pothole. And I think this is it. My car is wrecked, my steering wheel is bent sideways, but all is good. I gaze at the temple with wishful thoughts and I drive away from it and get to work. Late, of course. Because I wasn't going to let my job down. But I think to myself throughout the day, it's meant to be. This is where I restart, this is where I'm meant to be. Weeks later, I tell myself, what if, you know? I assume it wasn't time, but what if? What if I didn't have to get to work? What if my car was meant to break down? Because obviously I wasn't going to let my job down. But what if I didn't have to get to work? What if I got thrown a stroke of luck? Not the one I needed, but the one I had wanted to get to work. What if it had broken down? What if I had been to the temple? Why not? Who knows what may have happened. But I like thinking about it. This was Zachary Fleury speaking for 90.3 FM, CKUT. And thank you for listening to my story.
My name is Jennifer May, and this is Gifts from the Air. Johnny May is an Inuk from Kuchuk, Quebec, and he started his annual Christmas candy drop in 1965, when my father was just 12 years old. For many of us, we grew up waiting patiently for Christmas morning, not for Santa Claus, but for May to fly overhead of us and drop candy and gifts. You might have guessed it, but May is my very own uncle. Before I get into the candy drop, I'd like to share a little bit about my Uncle Johnny. Uncle Johnny became a pilot at the age of 17 and is known as being the first Inuk pilot of Eastern Canada. He is credited for saving the lives of many Inuit in search and rescue missions, as well as operating medevac flights to get sick Inuit to health centers. He is one of my heroes. Recently, on his 49th anniversary, he shared a funny tidbit, a unique tidbit. On the day of his wedding, he had to fly all day long and missed his wedding, which was supposed to be at 3 p.m. He got back at 7:30 and got married at 8. They had a wonderful celebration. The next morning, though, he had to leave at 7 a.m. for a medevac, but he brought his new bride with him. They never did go on a honeymoon, but they're still together all these years later. As I mentioned before, my father was just 12 years old when his older brother started the candy drop. But let me fast forward to a time when I was 12 and I can remember waking up on Christmas Day in Gujuak as a child. I would wake up on Christmas morning, find goodies in my stocking, open my gifts under the tree, admire all the wonderful things from my loved ones and Santa. But one thing that was hard to do was wait until my father said it was time to head over to the candy drop. When it was time to head over, it was also time to bundle up. It wasn't just cold out, it was usually minus 35, and the cold had a bite to it. So we had to dress up nice and warm, or our mother wouldn't let us out the door. When we got to the end of the runway, where the candy drop was usually held, we would meet and greet everyone we knew and hug all of our loved ones, wishing them a very Merry Christmas. It's not every day you get to see all of your friends and family at the same time. We would mingle and chat until we heard that familiar sound. That, my friends, was the typical sound of Uncle Johnny doing a flyby to let everyone know to get ready. He would then fly around again, and this time his trusty helpers would throw candy, gifts, and envelopes containing messages from "Sorry, try again next year" to "You have just won a $25 gift certificate." As I got older, my favorite part of the candy drop was seeing children running around with huge smiles on their faces, picking up candy and little gifts. Although my Uncle Johnny retired from the candy drop after more than 50 years, I was fortunate enough that my children were able to see the candy drop as I did when I was a child. My name is Jennifer May, for John Abbott on the Air.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the Air. I'm Evie Stockvis. See you next time.
These folks at CKUT love their 100% certified organic and fair trade gourmet coffee from Saint-Tropez. Prepared in the heart of Montreal with beans from all over the world, you can find and get your own cup of freshly brewed Saint-Tropez coffee from AUS Snacks on McGill Campus or from Café Saint-Tropez on the corner of Saint-Urbain and Duluth.
I need a fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh, fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh, fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Hey, hey, miss.
Hello, my name is Alia. I'm at CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Keep on rocking the free world. Keep on rocking the free world.
Samtidig med tid. Happy birthday. Feliz cumpleaños. Joyeux anniversaire. Happy birthday. Feliz cumpleaños. Happy birthday to you, joyeux anniversaire, samedi midi.